Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 13th of November. News yesterday that an Israeli tank struck a Syrian army vehicle after a mortar shell landed on Israeli-held territory gave many worries that Israel could be drawn into serious civil war. It's already done so to other neighbors, including Turkey and Lebanon. Israeli officials wondering if any of the cross-border fire has been intentional. Also in news the last couple days, the leader of Syria's new opposition coalition has called on European states to recognize it as the legitimate government and provide it with funds to buy the weapons that it needs to overthrow President Bashar al-Assad. We'll have two guests with us this hour to talk about all that's been going on. Joining us by phone from Cairo, where he is the Middle East and North Africa Bureau Chief for the Financial Times, Borzo Doregahi, also going on now in Cairo. The aforementioned leader of the coalition group is meeting with the Arab League in Cairo right now, and we'll talk about that meeting and all that's going on in this part of the world and the Syrian civil war. Later this hour, we will be speaking with a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, who chairs the program in Middle Eastern Studies. All hour, we welcome your phone calls, and here's how you can reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, if you'd like to use that, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Joining us from Cairo now is Borzo Doregahi. Borzo, thank you very much for joining us. Hello.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Could you start, please, with this meeting that is taking place right now, the Arab League in Cairo, where the leader of Syria's new opposition coalition has called on European states to recognize it as the legitimate government. What is the significance of this meeting? What is the significance of this call?
I mean, I think it's just one in a series of steps that could eventually lead to the creation of a legitimate, internationally recognized Syrian government in exile. What you have going on now is the second ever meeting of Arab League and European Union foreign ministers. It's kind of boring stuff, actually. The Arab League yesterday already recognized this newly created Syrian opposition formation as a legitimate representative of the Syrian people. The European Union is not going to do that anytime soon. They want to see what this group is about, first of all, before they do anything like that. So, you know, it's just a sort of long process of trying to get diplomatic recognition for this entity. I'm not sure if it means anything, if they do get that diplomatic recognition on the ground, for anything on the ground in Syria and the events transpiring there in terms of the civil war.
What is the group about?
Well, I think it's a very diverse, although not by any means totally complete, amalgamation of various exile groups, some with varying degrees of ties inside Syria, that you know, purports to represent the Syrian people. There's some various ideological groups that are involved, but there's a few also key groups, including Kurds, and including, an entity that is based in Syria, the National Coordinating Council, which consists of old-fashioned sort of opposition types who are still in Syria that are not included in this amalgamation.
Mm-hmm. And would you say that this opposition group has the good wishes of people who live in Syria or not?
No. I don't think that has any connection to the people who are fighting the rebellion now, the people who are taking part in occasional protests now. I think that those people, and I was just in Syria a few weeks ago in northern Syria, in Aleppo, with the rebel groups. Those people have lost complete faith both in their so-called representatives abroad and in the international community, and it would take quite a bit for that faith and those connections to be restored at this point.
What would it take? It sounds like they're between a rock and a hard place.
It would take guns, essentially.
Guns.
I think that the Syrian uprising has turned into a very vicious civil war that is beyond the control of any of the external players at this point. And that right now the Syrian rebels, those who are fighting against Bashar al-Assad, they don't really need the diplomatic recognition. They don't think that they need even food or relief supplies or anything like that. They need guns and money to buy guns. This is what I heard over and over and over again, especially anti-aircraft type weapons to bring down Bashar al-Assad's fighter jets, which give him a real edge in terms of this ongoing civil war.
Mm-hmm. Are they getting any of those supplies now from anyone?
They're getting them from somewhere, but it seems rather ragtag and haphazard. You know, a rich guy in the Gulf or a Syrian exile abroad, donates some money to buy some guns. There are some guns coming from Libya and other places that recently had revolutions that are very sympathetic to the Syrian uprising. But, you know, there's a boisterous gun trade in the Middle East, as you can imagine. And the Syrian rebels are now taking part in that and purchasing guns sometimes from Bashar al-Assad's own men, people who want to build up a fortune so that they can get out if the going gets really tough there.
Mm-hmm. This has all been going on for a long time now, hasn't it, Borzo?
Yeah, it's been going on for a long time. You know, it's been going on since March 2011, and by the sort of the smartest estimates I see from anyone, it's going to continue to go on for a long time. We should never forget, though, where it started and how it became so ugly. I was just going through. I used to work for the LA Times. And I was just going through some of my old clips. And I saw a front page story from April of 2011, and it was, big, huge headline saying that, Bashar al-Assad opens fire on peaceful demonstrators, without any provocation in front of the cameras, and it was all videotaped and documented. Back then, now that seems kind of humdrum. Yeah, Bashar al-Assad is killing his own people. But back then that was such a shocker that just that headline alone made the front page of a paper, way across the world. So we should keep in mind how this started, how this got so ugly, and who is ultimately responsible for this quagmire that is just seems to be getting worse and worse by the day.
We had news yesterday that an Israeli tank struck a Syrian army vehicle after a mortar shell landed on Israeli-held territory. News reports we're reading here indicate that some are worried that Israel could be drawn into Syria's civil war and that maybe this was intentional. What's your take?
Well, I mean, it's hard to get into the, intentions and thinking of the Bashar al-Assad's inner circle. But from the very beginning of this conflict, Bashar al-Assad decided that he could not win a widespread uprising against him as a leader representing a minority community inside Syria, which is, he's a minority Alawite in a country that's, overwhelmingly Sunni. So he tried to transform that conflict from a popular uprising into a armed struggle, turn the demonstrators into terrorists, so to speak, and then he can just get the international legitimacy to crush them. Well, that didn't work out. He seems to be now trying to transform the conflict into a imperialist Zionist intervention into his country, and that way win international support and sort of cling on to power. And so you had these very provocative moves against Turkey along the Turkish border that drew Turkish fire and has inspired some people in Ankara to demand that Turkey get more involved in this. And then you had this incident happening. We're not sure if it was an accident or intentional, but it happened 2 days in a row where mortar fire landed in the Golan Heights, which is, Israel claims as part of its own territory. And this has raised again the question of whether Bashar al-Assad is trying to, again, try to transform the conflict from an uprising against him into something else that he thinks he may be able to win.
Mm-hmm. And what about, would you classify any of the members of the opposition as terrorists?
I mean, I think that, some of the, it's really complicated. Some of the opposition folks are very, very extreme Islamists, so-called jihadis, who may have had past experiences in other conflicts in the region, who may have taken part, for example, in the insurgency in Iraq or in Afghanistan, and have had the sort of prototypical kind of experience of what we would call a terrorist. But I think those people are very, very small, very tiny in number. And you also have this other phenomenon because of the nature of the conflict where, people, Syrians who are, by any, measure, and I've been in the region for years and known a lot of Syrians and spent a lot of time in Syria, generally kind of secular, open-minded people pretending to be more Islamic than they are in order to get funding from the people who are giving them money right now, which is the hardcore Islamists in the Persian Gulf countries and the Arabian Peninsula.
How has Bashar al-Assad been able to hold on to power for so long if he is in a minority and governing a majority Sunni population? Is it just strength in arms and in weapons?
I think there's two answers to that question. One is that he's really not in charge anymore. Huge swaths of the country in the north, in the south, in the west, in huge parts of Damascus, the country's largest city, Aleppo, huge parts of it are no longer under his control. So he's not really in control of the country anymore. And the main thing is the loyalty of the armed forces. He has managed to keep the armed forces mostly under his control, and that is because of this very complicated sectarian system that his father, Hafez al-Assad, had set up and he inherited, where the officer corps hails from his Alawite community. But in general, he's really not in control of large sections of the country anymore.
Who is?
That's a really good question. You've had these, these sort of local councils that have sprung up among the revolutionaries, people who've set up their own court systems, people who've set up their own dispute resolution systems. They set up their own local governance to handle things like power lines falling, to handle things like securing water and relief supplies for citizens and so on. So basically, no one is in charge of huge sections of the country.
How many people, Borzu, have left the country?
It's a good question. Actually, I was just speaking the other day with the head of the UNHCR, Mr. Antonio Guterres, and he was estimating to me, this was like 2 weeks ago, that 600,000 people have fled the country, and not those include people who are registered refugees as well as people who are they have a passport and they're, spending this year in another country and they're not registering as refugees, or people who are just kind of living off the grid, hand to mouth, as they're scouring various countrysides. So 600,000 out of a population of 22 million, that's a pretty large chunk of the people.
Yes, it is. We welcome phone calls. We're talking about Syria, the long civil war there, the current news that an Israeli tank struck a Syrian army vehicle after a mortar shell landed on Israeli-held territory. That happened yesterday, and there are questions raised now as to whether or not Israel could be drawn into Syria's civil war. We're looking at what's happened with Turkey and Lebanon, and who the opposition is, how strong they are. Their announcement that they are unified and they formed an umbrella group on Sunday asking for international recognition and also asking for arms so they can carry on their battle. We're trying to get an understanding of who these groups are. And we welcome your phone calls. We have two guests with us this hour. Our guest is joining us by phone from Cairo, where he is Middle East and North Africa Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. Borzu Daragahi is our first guest. Our phone number here is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. You can always leave messages for us on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, we will be talking about Kurt Vonnegut's letters. They are just fabulous, and we have two great guests with us. Dan Wakefield, who first befriended Kurt Vonnegut in 1963. He, like Vonnegut, was also born and raised in Indianapolis, and we will speak with him. He has put these letters together. Also, Mark Vonnegut, who is Kurt's son, and has written a couple books himself and is a good friend of Dan's as well, will be with us. Kurt Vonnegut's letters. He is a person who kept in touch with many, many people throughout the course of his life. So friendships go way back. All right, let's go to phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're talking about Syria. We're talking about, you can't talk about Syria without now talking about Israel and Lebanon and Turkey and the civil war that's been going on there and refugees and pretty much an utter mess for a long, long time. Mary Jo in Appleton is our first caller. Hi, Mary Jo.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My husband is Syrian. He's from Dara, where the uprising began, and he's a human rights activist, and we stayed very, very close. He's worked in the refugee camps in Jordan in August, and this is first and foremost, I think, for all Syrians who are all across the world. And my comment or question is, I think it's misleading to characterize the conflict as a civil war. I think that's one of the things that has really caused inaction on the part of the international community. I did hear your guest say that, you know, on one hand, characterizing it as a civil war, and then on the other hand, that clearly the regime, the Assad regime, is responsible for the uprising. But, you know, Syria has a long history of being a very moderate, very open society and non-secular. And it's really the regime that's fanning the flames of sectarianism and creating, you know, fear amongst different groups, diversity groups inside of Syria. So I think we really have to be careful because, when we call it a civil war, I think it just, again, causes inaction on the part of the international community as if this can't be solved, you know, as if we can't provide support. So
thank you very much for the call. You may want to stay with us. You may have another comment after Borzu's comment. Borzu?
Well, I'm not going to argue the semantics. As a journalist, I just sort of call it, we called it a civil war in Iraq when it was, you know, this sort of, ugly sectarian fight between the Shiites and the Sunnis. And, you know, it's slowly become, what else would you call it when you have two groups of people, each now under different flags, with guns killing each other across a whole country? But I see her point, and I, you know, sympathize with the political sentiments expressed there. But, for us, it's not a, for us as journalists, it's not a, calling it a civil war is more of a technical term than an ideological term. But I see her point in terms of saying that it's sort of intractable. But to me, it's also just an empirical description.
Would you like to respond, Mary Jo?
Well, again, I think if the regime would go, you would see an end to the violence. So I think, it's not an issue of semantics. I think it has, words have a lot of power to them. And I think when we do call it a civil war, I don't think we can compare it to Iraq because it's a very different situation. This was not an outside force coming into Iraq. This was a popular uprising, a peaceful popular uprising, with a government who is so corrupt that they were willing to turn guns, tanks, airplanes on its own people, anything to stay in power, this regime. They have no limits to their inhumanity. So I think when we hear that, it sounds like it's intractable. I think that it sounds like we've got groups of different Syrians fighting against one another because of their ideological beliefs or their religious beliefs, and that's not true. You have people who are armed now because they were desperate, because they were getting slaughtered, just absolutely slaughtered. I mean, upwards of now 45,000 dead, many of them women and children. You know, my husband's hometown is bombed every single, day this weekend. They were bombed. They were without electricity. They were, they're targeting physicians, killing physicians who are treating people in field hospitals and in the streets. It's just, this is an absolute corrupt government. And I think if we would see the Assad regime go, we would see the return of, Syrians who are willing to risk everything for the things that we really believe here in the United States, freedom of expression, liberty, justice. They've been living under a regime, 42 years of a corrupt regime, that the father was willing to kill upwards of, estimates between 20 and 40,000 back in 1982 in a popular uprising against the government. So
thank you very much for your call, Mary Jo. Would you agree with her assessment? If the regime would go, there would be an end to the violence, Borzu?
I mean, I really like Syria, and I really like Syrians, and, you know, I was, one could not help but be very sympathetic to the aims of the revolution last year, you know, and that what they were fighting for was, you know, freedom, liberty, and more important than anything, just the dignity to live in a country without fear. But right now, the situation is such that you have so many different armed groups. Like I was just in Aleppo and I saw it, I experienced it. I won't get into it because it'll be a long story. But you know, you have so many different armed groups with, you know, slightly different agendas. I think it would be better if Bashar al-Assad would go, but I don't think by any means one could say that at this point it would be the end of Syria's troubles, which appear to be very, very vast and deep at this point.
Mm-hmm. And what about the response of the international community? Is there something that could be done, do you think, that would keep so many people from being killed, that would get him out of power and some government in power that is just?
Well, I think that, for example, the idea that was floated to have a sort of buffer zone in the north, I think that helping out the rebels would be one thing that the external powers could do. You would do, you know, for example, like in Libya, where you had the no-fly zone in eastern Libya, you would have a buffer zone in the north encompassing Aleppo and Idlib and preventing regime aircraft from entering that area. Under penalty of being shot down by NATO forces. I think that is one solution that the rebels themselves would love to see. And then, you know, at that point, the rebels and the Syrian opposition could start building a real civil society and a real alternative to Bashar al-Assad, so that if and when the regime falls, they can take over, and the outcome won't be as scary and chaotic as it could be if things are just a free-for-all.
Mm-hmm. What's everybody thinking, that Bashar al-Assad is just going to leave when he gets tired of all this?
He won't leave. He will leave when he is... I mean, you remember how ugly Muammar Gaddafi's death was.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and that was a horrible situation. I went to Misrata and saw his corpse in the meat locker where they kept it, and the sort of the whole spirit of the thing was very macabre. I think that this will be even worse than that.
Thanks, Mary Jo. Let's go to Bill in Madison. By the way, we have lines open if you'd like to join our conversation. 800-486-8655 is our number. Bill, hello.
Hi. One short comment and then followed by my main question. I think it's telling that when the Soviet Union collapsed, and basically, and I think it was 1991, as bad as the Soviet government could be at its worst, in the end, they were not willing to turn and fire on their own people. And that's why the Soviet system collapses. Basically, they were, in the end, willing to turn their tanks and planes and start shooting at their own. I think that's very telling in terms of how it compares with Syria.
Borzu, would you like to comment?
Well, absolutely. This is one of the main things that people have been pointing to, main differences between Tunisia and Egypt on the one hand, and Libya and Syria on the other hand. You know, this was why the transitions in Egypt and Tunisia were relatively smooth after the revolutions there last year. Whereas in Libya and Syria, you had the armed forces, defending the leader and the system until the very, very last moment that was possible. And, you know, you had a much more chaotic outcomes. In Libya, a much more chaotic outcome in Libya that's still sort of continuing to be chaotic. It's going to be possibly even worse in Syria, given the continuing civil war and the deterioration of state institutions and so on.
Can I finish with my question?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. It seems that there's a lot of people who are reluctant to... to go into Syria, and this is just my point of view, but I think there's many others who probably share it, is that the lessons of Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as I think to a large degree Libya, are that no matter what we do, whether we do nothing or whether we do something, but certainly whether we do something, there are always going to be unintended consequences that are going to be bad for either us or for them or both. And so we're standing here with our thumbs, twiddling our thumbs, saying, well, let's do nothing because at least we're not going to get blamed that much. Of course, now we are getting blamed for doing nothing. Yeah. But it just seems like the powerlessness, you know, I feel like we should do something, but there's really nothing we can do that's not going to make it worse in some respect.
Boise.
Yeah, I think there's a real fear, a real reluctance to get involved in this. But I mean, as some people have pointed about, though, you know, to people who say that we shouldn't get involved because it'll you know get worse. How much worse can it get at this point? You know, you have a situation right now where the war is, you know, has totally spilled over into Lebanon, where you have, you know, daily clashes between Alawites and Sunnis, where you have assassinations of major figures. The conflict is spread into Turkey, where you have this massive influx of refugees. You have, the sort of exchange of shell fire between Turkey and Syria, and now Israel getting involved. Tens of thousands of refugees in Jordan, and that's not even looking at the number of thousands of refugees that have fled Syria and gone to North African countries and to Europe. So maybe there are some unintended consequences of not getting involved, but there are some definite consequences of the other way around as well.
Do you see some of these actions, be it Lebanon or Turkey or now Israel, as being a tipping point for all of this, for international involvement, for more involvement than what we've seen, which is not much?
No, not yet. I don't think so. I think no one wants to get involved in this because it's just too unpredictable. It's too dangerous. It's too volatile. Mm. International attention is focused too much elsewhere, and Syria has too many international friends. That includes not just Iran, but you know, more importantly, Russia and China, which both have vetoes on the Security Council and both supply Syria with its military hardware.
Why? Why are they friends?
I mean, they see this, and this is the sort of, sad part of this. They don't see the Syrian people as, you know, people who are struggling for democracy that should be helped. They see Syria as a piece on the chessboard, and they see that, you know, the West got Libya, and, they see Syria as another spot on the chessboard that they don't want the West to get control of. They see it as part of Russia, especially sees it as part of its sphere of influence. Remember a few years back what Russia did when Georgia, the state of Georgia, the nation of Georgia tried to join NATO. It actually, you know, sparked a war and invaded the country and put an end to those plans. This is the same kind of thing where, you know, Syria is part of the Russian sphere of influence. It gives Russia a warm water port. It's a market for its weapons. It's a friendly country. It has been since the time of Hafez al-Assad. And so they don't want to lose that. That's basically it.
Mm-hmm. And tell me a little bit more about Turkey's response to all of this. That's a pretty big deal to have all those refugees in your country and to be worried about a shelling of your country when really you have very little to do with what's going on internally in Syria.
Yeah, I mean, Turkey is conflicted. Turkey is a very dynamic, democratic country, and there's many different opinions, even within the ruling elite, about what should be done about Syria. So it's worthwhile to, like, read the English language Turkish newspapers and just see the diversity of mm-hmm. ideas that are being, you know, bandied about. But, you know, they're very scared of what's happening there. They don't want to go it alone. They're not going to. It's unprecedented for Turkey or any other Middle Eastern country to, do some kind of humanitarian intervention without the umbrella of the West helping them, giving them legitimacy. And so they're you know, sort of stuck between a rock and a hard place themselves.
Mm-hmm. So what are you covering today? Probably quite a bit.
Yeah, just sort of, you know, focusing in on the Arab League meeting here in Cairo and, just keeping an eye on things that are going on in the region as well as Egyptian politics.
Thank you, Borzu, very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Borzu Daragahi, Middle East and North Africa Bureau Chief for the Financial Times, joining us by phone from Cairo, where he is based. We're going to continue our conversation looking at U.S. hands-off so far, international response to what's going on in Syria, the coalition, and I'm interested in a little bit more of the makeup of this coalition that was announced on Sunday, a coalition of rebel groups forming this umbrella group. They are now in Cairo at the Arab League asking for recognition and also asking for arms. Should they be granted those? Stephen Zunes is a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he chairs the program in Middle Eastern Studies. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Zunes, thank you so much for joining us here again. Hello.
Pleasure to be on.
Can you give us a little more information now about this coalition of rebel groups? They formed an umbrella group. They are in Cairo asking for recognition, asking for arms. How many groups are we talking about? What's the makeup of this opposition?
It's more diverse than the Syrian National Council, which was the idea. I mean, this is what the United States was really pressing, because there was concern that it was not truly representative, that the old Syrian National Council was dominated by exiles, many of whom had not been in the country for many, many years. There's also concern about the disproportionate influence of the Muslim Brotherhood. Despite their effort towards the end to try to broaden themselves, they brought in a left-leaning Christian leader who'd been in the country until very recently, George Sabra, at the last minute. But still, there was a recognition that they needed to broaden it a bit to include more people who are representative of the ongoing resistance inside the country.
Mm-hmm. And all those groups get along with each other?
No, I mean the assumption is that somehow this broader group will bicker less than the smaller group, which is not guaranteed.
Mm-hmm. So, but they have coalesced, they've gotten together, and they've gone to ask for what? International recognition as what? What are they asking for?
Well, eventually, they want recognition as the sole legitimate representative of the opposition. But they want to see this as the first step of being recognized as a government in exile. And this would mean, for example, if there would be a decent swath of territory that is liberated from control of the regime, perhaps they could be recognized as the sole legitimate government of Syria, which could then open up the way for more direct aid or even foreign intervention.
Do you think they should be recognized as such?
Well, I think having a broad-based representative opposition group, I think, is important. Certainly, in terms of trying to bring an end to the bloodshed and some kind of negotiated settlement. The problem is that among the 12-point programs of this new coalition, they explicitly rule out any form of negotiation. Now, I can certainly understand, given all the broken promises of the Assad regime, why there would be skepticism on the part of the opposition. But at the same time, it's pretty clear that the armed struggle is not going to defeat Assad, at least not in the short term, and not without an enormous amount of bloodshed for many, many months to come.
You think this guy is going to sit down and negotiate, though?
Well, I mean, it depends. I mean, the best analogy I can see is a situation like South Africa, which was also a minority regime, also in a country with ethnic divisions. And what they did there was they recognized that the armed struggle was not going to liberate South Africa. The main thrust needed to be in civil resistance, in the townships and elsewhere, strikes, boycotts, forming alternative institutions and the like, combined with targeted international sanctions, create a situation where the economic elites of the country had to go to the Afrikaners in power and say, hey guys, the gig is up. We cannot go on like this indefinitely. You need to release Mandela, talk to the ANC, and negotiate some kind of transition of power. The problem is since the armed struggle has subsumed the civil resistance in Syria, they are essentially meeting the regime on its strongest point, the military force. And so, and in the regime, and unfortunately, both sides think they can win. And though in reality, it's just going to get a lot more people killed.
Mm-hmm. And what ultimately do you think would bring al-Assad to any kind of negotiating table? Why would he do that?
Well, you know, the problem with Syria is that unlike Tunisia and Libya and Egypt and Yemen, you know, regimes that have been overthrown in the past year or so, they were led by essentially singular figures, one-man rule. Whereas Syria is a lot more complicated. It's not just Assad. You know, it's the Ba'ath Party. It's the military. It's their ability, is the ability through divide and rule to get a number of the minorities on their side. It's this large network of crony capitalists who actually happen to be mostly Sunni Muslims, who have been cultivated. The regime has shared the goodies, if you will, to these Sunni elites. So there are a lot of people who have a stake in the system. In other words, the regime has a much broader social base than these other countries that faced rebellions. A minority, to be sure, but a fairly sizable minority. And as a result, whether it's a nonviolent struggle or a violent struggle, it's going to be a lot harder to force the regime out. What you need to do is peel away the pillars of the regime to join the other side, or at least to pressure Assad to make some kind of arrangement for a departure. But unfortunately, with the armed struggle, it just solidifies the support of the regime because it just feeds Assad's narrative that these are a bunch of crazy foreign-backed terrorists that are going to kill all of you if we don't exterminate them. Whereas a nonviolent struggle, or a mostly nonviolent struggle, is far less threatening, and you get a lot more sympathy for the opposition, because when soldiers gun down innocent civilians, it obviously alienates people from the regime. But when they're shooting people that are shooting at them, it's seen as legitimate.
Mm-hmm. And what are those? You mentioned that they share goodies, which keeps them loyal to Assad. What are the goodies?
Well, basically, economic favors, exclusive contracts, monopolies, that kind of thing. I mean, despite the socialist rhetoric of the regime, the one form of liberalization that the younger Assad has done has been economic, not political. But and ironically, despite the socialist identity, this is the most working class base of any of the Arab rebellions. Which has polarized the situation even further.
What would happen if, for whatever reason, in the course of this week, the Assad regime would fall? Would everything be much more peaceful in Syria?
Well, most of the violence has come from the government. And in that sense, hopefully a lot less people would be killed. But unfortunately, another problem with armed struggle is that unlike an unarmed civil insurrection where you have to build a broad coalition of forces, in armed struggle, it's an elite vanguard with martial values, with a clear military hierarchy that gets the message that power comes through the barrel of a gun. And so, it tends to be a less democratic kind of structure, and oftentimes, in fact, we've seen historically when dictators have been overthrown by nonviolent struggle, most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time, it evolves into a stable democracy within a few years. Whereas if dictators are overthrown through armed struggle, it's much more likely that they will end up either as a new dictatorship or will fall into factional fighting, And so one hope of bringing this Syrian National Coalition together is that they can have some semblance of unity to minimize that threat that things will factionalize. However, at this point, it's hard to say what would happen if suddenly there was this power vacuum.
Our guest this part of the show is Professor Stephen Zunes. He's professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he chairs the program in Middle Eastern Studies. We're talking about Syria this hour of the program. It's been going on for a long time, of course, but some of the recent news is an Israeli tank, we have to ask Stephen about this, struck a Syrian army vehicle. There are concerns that Israel could be drawn into Syria's civil war. Turkey and Lebanon already have been, and also this coalition of rebel groups forming an umbrella group on Sunday in Cairo before the Arab League, asking for recognition and also asking for arms. What do you think? What about the response of the international community? Is there more that the United States should be doing, could be doing? We welcome your phone calls if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655 is the number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, or you can always leave messages for us on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program this Tuesday, Kurt Vonnegut Letters. They have been recently published, the introduction and editing of the letters done by Dan Wakefield, a longtime friend of Kurt Vonnegut's, who was also born and raised in Indianapolis. He will be with us, as will Mark Vonnegut. Mark is also an author, one of Kurt Vonnegut's children. The book is just fascinating because Vonnegut kept in touch with people since his childhood, and it includes dramatic letters about the time when he was a POW, his correspondence with famous literary names, his concerns about his family, letters with his children and his wife, and it's just fascinating. So that will come up. Dan will be with us, and Mark Vonnegut will be with us, hour two of our show today. Our phone number, if you'd like to join this conversation, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email, if you'd like to use that form of communication, is talk@wpr.org. And you can also leave messages always for us on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Stephen Zunes is professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he chairs the program in Middle Eastern Studies. Let's go to Kay in Superior. Hi, Kay.
Hi. I just finished listening to a book on audio or cassette, not CD. It's called The Sandcastle Girls by Chris, Bajalian. And it's about the Armenian struggle in 1915 in Aleppo. It was fascinating to know that the struggles are just ongoing for a century, and or that they started or maybe were just, it's a continuation for the people who live there of so many struggles. It's unbelievable. I just like a comment from the professor, and I'll get off the air.
Thanks, Kay.
Oh, yeah, one of the complex things about Syria is that there it's a mosaic of ethnicities and religions. And to Assad's credit, as repressive as his regime, his father's regime has been, they were very much wielded to this Arab secular nationalism. You know, that it was that they were not fundamentalists. They minority groups are actually disproportionately represented in many cases in the regime. Now, you know, one could say that was part of the divide and rule strategy, which obviously it was. At the same time, it has worked in the sense that many of these minorities do ally with the government, seeing it's a less bad option. And the fact that some of the rebel fighters, those with more extremist Sunni Muslim chauvinistic worldview, have attacked and destroyed Christian churches, have attacked Alawites, Armenians, other minorities in the area, which of course has been used by the regime to justify their repression and the like. One reason that the United States and other countries really pushed for this new coalition was that there was fear of too much domination by religious Sunni Muslim groups. They wanted to try to get the message that the opposition is for everybody, which is a theme that they really pushed in this document that brought them together. Whether or not that will be recognized in reality, I think, is another question. Again, it will come down to whether the struggle will remain primarily an armed one, or will they be able to revive the largely nonviolent civil insurrection that had dominated the uprising in its earlier months.
Mm-hmm. Can you give me a little bit more of the history, the background of the al-Assad family?
Well, they're Alawites, which is a minority similar to Shias, that's concentrated in the northwestern part of the country. When the French colonialists controlled the area in the earlier part of the 20th century, they did what British and other colonialists did in various parts of the world, and that they cultivated a minority to play a disproportionate role in the new military they were setting up. Again, in the idea that they would seek foreign, the foreign protection, from the Sunni Muslim majority. Well, the Assad was one of these who staged a coup when he was the head of the Air Force in 1970. Now, many people thought it would be just yet another of a whole string of military regimes that generally only lasted a year or two before the next coup came along. But he was shrewd enough to be able to, and ruthless enough, to cobble together a coalition that has ended up surviving all of these years.
And how many years has it been now?
Well, Assad, Assad was in power for 30 years and then brought in his son to take his place when he died in 2000. Now, the irony of that is that, of course, the whole principle behind Ba'athism, this secular Arab nationalist movement, was to reject the dynasties of the kingdoms that the Western-backed family dictatorships that you saw in Jordan and in the in the Gulf region and elsewhere, and so bringing in his son who was actually not the favorite son. His favorite son was killed in an accident. Bashir actually was one who, the son who became the president actually was an ophthalmologist who had initially not seen much interest in politics. When he first came to power, he liberalized things somewhat, but the so-called Damascus Spring didn't last very long and ended up being cracking down brutally, just as his father had.
Mm-hmm. So would it be fair to say that this regime was okay before it wasn't okay?
I mean, it was okay in the sense that it was a relatively stable, country, and that, minorities, did have rights and that kind of thing, but they could certainly be ruthless to any opponents. In 1982, there was a hardline Sunni Muslim uprising. That was brutally crushed. Thousands of people were killed within days, and they were thorough enough. Also, was that the secret police were so strong and everything that civil society was weak. And that's another reason that the regime has not has had more staying power than places like Egypt and Tunisia, where civil society was somewhat stronger. The other thing that's rather interesting is that, had the regime been smarter in the early days of the protest, back in February of last year, using less repression and bringing in some genuine, if minor, reforms, they could have done what the Jordan did and Morocco did and Oman did, which was basically nip the protest in the bud. But instead, they cracked down with extreme brutality, and it ended up spiraling out of control, even despite the fact that in many ways the opposition was not nearly as ready as we saw in Egypt and Tunisia. I mean, a lot of people think these uprisings are spontaneous, when in many cases they have been the culmination of years and years of struggle and organizing and smaller demonstrations and building networks, et cetera, et cetera. And that was indeed the case Egypt and Tunisia, but in Syria, it really has been something of an ad hoc effort, and not to mention the extreme divisions. So whereas in these other countries you had a unified opposition and divided regime, in Syria we've ended up with a united regime and a divided opposition.
And finally, just about a minute left, a little less than that. Do you think that Israel is being intentionally drawn into this?
No, I don't think so. There, you know, in that it would complicate things somewhat. And the Israelis do know that it would be a mistake to be drawn in a big way. I mean, obviously, the regime would like to see a confrontation with Israel as long as it didn't get too much, because they across the board in Syria, they don't like the fact that Israel has occupied the Golan Heights for all these years, and all the Syrians want it back. And the fact that, despite Assad's repression, he has agreed to recognize Israel and have peace and disarm the Golan and all those sorts of things. He's agreed to the Land for Peace formula, but the Israelis have rejected that. He knew that a peace agreement, would be to his favor, and in fact, the Bush administration effectively blocked the Israelis from negotiating an agreement back in 2007 when Assad, did try to sue for peace.
Okay.
But again, Assad will do whatever he can to exaggerate external enemies as a way of consolidating his power more.
Thank you so much for being with us. Professor Stephen Zunes, Professor of Politics and International Studies at the University of San Francisco. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning for producing this program. Tomorrow during this hour, the proposal to increase aid to public schools. State Superintendent Tony Evers will be one of our guests tomorrow. News is coming up in a great hour to follow. Please stay with us on the Ideas Network.